I came along to, well, it wasn't Tri Ratna then, it was the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order in 1974 when I was 17. I went to a house in an area just outside Brighton called Preston Park. Some of you might know Preston Park. And there was an order member there named Buddhadasa, who was running classes at the house of the people who ran the Brighton Buddhist Society. Very lovely people. And he was in Brighton to start a centre, and they would very kindly put him up in their house and let him run classes in their library. Their sort of front room was a library with all these wonderful Buddhist books, and they had a big shrine. And so my first evening, first time I went along, I learnt a full five-stage metta bhavana with very little instruction, nothing about posture, nothing like that. No wonder I've got a bad back. I tried to sit in full lotus, of course. Full length metta bhavana. And then the Sevenfold Puja, that was my first contact with the concluding mantras and so on. No explanation, straight into the puja in this candle-lit room with a lovely shrine with Buddha figures on it. And by the end of the puja, I remember it very vividly, chanting the mantras, I knew that I was going to devote my life to Buddhism. I even knew I was going to be an order member. I had this sort of joyful sense of knowing that this was going to be my life. And it was definitely the puja that did that. And I'm so grateful to Buddhadasa that he let me go to a class for the sort of regulars on my first contact, and that he did a sevenfold puja, because this is exactly what I was looking for. If he'd taught me meditation as I was to go on to teach meditation eventually, very gently, lots of relaxation, slowly, 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 I wouldn't have been interested. I would not have been interested. Now, I'm not criticizing that approach to meditation and to Dharma, but it would not have appealed to me. I was definitely looking for, if you like, Buddhist religion, Buddhist ritual. I'd been reading books by Lama Govinda about Tibetan Buddhism. I wanted, if you like, a religion without a god, but I didn't want a religion without ritual and mystery and reverence and devotion and faith. And I also am very, very grateful to Bhante that he introduced this particular puja to our movement. He used these verses that had been translated by a friend of his, Mrs. A.A.G. Bennett. He arranged the verses into the seven stages of the puja. I'm really grateful because for me, it changed my life. It's why I'm a Buddhist. It's why I'm here. It all goes back to that experience. I'm enormously grateful to Buddhadasa, to Bhante, to Mrs. Bennett, to Shantideva, who composed the verses in the first place, from Shantideva's great work, the Bodhicaryavatara. And I have, for that reason, a lot of faith in the Sevenfold Puja. Yes, there are other pujas that one can do and they can be very inspiring, but for me, the Sevenfold Puja is the absolute sort of bedrock of devotional practice, because I've had such a transforming experience doing that practice. I didn't know at the time that, well, I didn't know anything at the time. And I should just as well say that this experience of knowing I was going to devote my life to Buddhism, there's no insight here. There's no experience of any kind of glimpse of enlightenment, just to be very, very clear about that. I was a very confused, foolish adolescent. But somehow, in the midst of all that, there was something else. There was something that opened up for me, that showed me the way I wanted to live my life, which I just could not refuse and could not ignore. And very shortly after that, I left home and joined Buddhadasa in the little community he started in Brighton, the first Brighton centre. And probably not so long after that, I found out more about the puja in Bhante's lecture. Like I said in the first talk, probably heard on a reel-to-reel tape recorder, Bhante's lecture, The Awakening of the Bodhi Heart, which of course is the name of this retreat, The Awakening of the Bodhi Heart, which is the second lecture in the series, Aspects of the Bodhisattva Ideal. It's one of my all-time favourite Bhante lectures. It's absolutely formative to my understanding and feeling for the Dharma, and it's never really been replaced. Yes, there have been refinements and developments in Bhante's thought over the years, but in terms of the sort of essence of that talk, that's foundational for me. You know, even coming through a clunky tape recorder, something was coming through. Through to me, sitting there in a room in Preston Park or in George Street in Brighton. I can't remember where I first heard it. We did a lot of that in those days, just listening to Bhante's lectures. But in The Awakening of the Bodhi Heart, The Awakening of the Bodhi Heart is Bhante's poetic rendering of Bodhicittottapada. Bodhicittottapada. So it's Bodhicitta plus Utpada. So Utpada means arising, coming into being, rising up. But arising is probably the best translation. Quite an important word, Utpada. Creation, even. Arising and creation. And Bodhicitta is, as you know, as Bhante really explained, is really untranslatable and really sort of unutterable. He started off in his lecture by talking about how it's often translated as thought of enlightenment. You'll probably come across this in your study of Buddhist text. You come across this phrase, the thought of enlightenment. Well, the thought of enlightenment is probably a translation of bodhicitta. And Bhante said in that lecture, remember it very vividly, he said, that's exactly what it isn't. The bodhicitta is not thinking about enlightenment. That's exactly what it's not. Yes, citta can be translated as mind or heart or even will. Could be translated as thought. That's quite possible. And bodhi can be translated as enlightenment and so on. But to say that the bodhicitta is the thought of enlightenment is a great mistake. And he said it's not just a problem of translation. He said actually the word bodhicitta is not a good word for the bodhicitta. I think it's very important to remember this as we go deeper into the retreat and do these practices. Bhante's caution, the bodhicitta is not a good word for the bodhicitta because it's something altogether beyond articulation, altogether beyond conceiving, altogether beyond any kind of utterance. And he explored this by referring to a short and little, not so well-known work by the great Indian Acharya Nagarjuna in a short work of his on the bodhicitta, which I came to later understand was called the Bodhicitta Vivarana, which means something like the revealing of the bodhicitta. And Nagarjuna, as Bhante joyfully unfolded, very excited in communicating this, how Nagarjuna's description of the bodhicitta gives us a tremendous clue to what it is. Because Nagarjuna says that the bodhicitta is not found in the five skandhas. It's not found in any of the constituents of conditioned existence. He goes further, he says it's not actually found in any of the sense media. It's not found anywhere in our conditioned categories whatsoever. Bodhicitta is shunyata, and it's anatman. It's emptiness, and it's also without any substance. Bhante's reading of this is tremendous. Nagarjuna also says, just to add, although it is not found in any of these conditioned things, it is also called the Mahakarana Chitta, the great compassionate heart. And bodhisattvas find their meaning of existence, they derive their meaning of existence from the bodhicitta, this transcendent, great, compassionate heart. So that's very, very important too. But Bhante's reading of this, his insight into this, and I think it is a unique insight, although in a way it's articulating the spirit of particularly of Shantideva and some of the great Mahayana writers and some of the great Mahayana sutras. He takes this to mean that the bodhicitta is more like the eruption in the conditioned, to use that language, of the unconditioned, of the transcendental, to use that language. So it's not a thinking about anything. The bodhicitta, traditionally, the way he reads it, is the emergence, the arising, yes, even the eruption of this force of wisdom and compassion in the direction of the full realization of wisdom and compassion for the alleviation of the suffering, for, as Bhante says in the lecture, very almost biblically, for the full redemption of all life, the full liberation of all life in enlightenment. So he said that's a bit different from the thought of enlightenment. He uses an analogy, and he said it's only analogy. He's not saying it's the same thing. He said, when you talk about the descent of the Holy Spirit on the disciples, that's, you know, it sounds very impressive, doesn't it? It sounds very dramatic. He said, in the same way, the arising of the bodhicitta is more like that. It's not the same thing as the Holy Spirit. Totally different system. Don't get confused. I know it's Christmas time, but it's not all is one. We're talking in a non-theistic, totally non-theistic context, etc. So just all the scare marks there. But you're open, if you like, what's going on with the bodhicitta through your practice, through your many, many different practice, the intensity of your practice, you're opening up to this force of wisdom and compassion, which isn't yours, which isn't your own personal possession, which is working through you for the liberation of all life. That's what the arising of the bodhicitta is more like that. That's what he said in that lecture. Now, I found this, he also made the point that there aren't many bodhicittas. This is another really crucial insight. It's not that there's not my bodhicitta and your bodhicitta. There's only one bodhicitta, cue for a song. Football chant, actually. There's only one bodhicitta. Sorry, that's going to be an earworm for you now, isn't it? There's only one bodhicitta, and it manifests in so many different individuals. And he uses this image from Mahayana Buddhism of the moon, and we've got a wonderful moon up there, reflected in so many different bodies of water. So the one bodhicitta is reflected in all many different individuals, though he says that image is a bit static, that metaphor. You have to think of something more in motion, more dynamic, more transformative. Hence his translation in the puja of the bodhicitta as the will to enlightenment. But it's not your will, it's not my will, it's, if you like, a sort of cosmic will, if you like. Although all that language is very poetic. Again, don't take all this literally, because you have to keep in mind Nagarjuna Shunyata. So don't get yourself into all sorts of weird problems. But it seems also to be reflected in the way in which the great, if you like, human bodhisattvas actually talk about their experience of bodhicitta. Shantideva, who is the most, in a sense, as far as I know, the most sort of confessional, the most, in the sense of the most personal, the most intimate in trying to describe the experience of bodhicitta. He says things, it's quite clear when you read it that the bodhicitta is not his. It's this wonderful thing, this wonderful event, this wonderful conversion, transformation, turning around, that has happened and which he has to serve. It's quite clear if you read the first two or three, four chapters of the Bodhicharyavatara, that's what he's describing. It's something has happened. Something extraordinary has happened. We don't, for a moment, well, it would have happened in a sort of eternal space, a timeless space. His life has been turned round completely. And somehow or other, he knows that he has to live a life to gain enlightenment for and with the whole of life. That's what's happened. Is, if you like, he's wedded. He's become wedded to all life. He's become wedded to all life. Something transfiguring has happened. And he can't go back from that, even though it becomes a little bit scary for him as it goes on, when he starts to think about what would happen if I did step back from this experience. Going back to my initial experience of listening to Bhante's lecture, and probably related to the puja, I felt completely thrilled by what I was hearing. This was describing the kind of spiritual life, the Buddhist life, that I really wanted. I say that mindful of the fact that I don't regard myself in any way, shape or form as somebody with any particular feeling for compassion. Certainly not then, and I'm not even sure now. It's not that I sort of feel, I felt moved to kind of get involved in, social work or activist work or anything of that nature. But the description of a Buddhist life where you are striving to open up to something beyond you, which, result, you're moving in that direction, if you like, you're sending something forth out there, and there's some sort of response from, let's call it, something transcendental, which has to include everybody and all life. That makes complete sense to me. That makes complete and utter sense. Why it makes sense, I don't know. Maybe it's to do with sort of early experiences, pre-Buddhist experiences, if you could call mystical or something like that, without trying to sound too pompous. But that's the kind of life that I knew that I wanted to lead. The idea of that Buddhist life is just for your own limited personal psychological development, actually fills me with horror to think of it in those terms. I find that actually terrifying, to think that it could be reduced to that. But the fact that you're living a life that is opening up to, well, let's say, use the traditional language, to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, to their Adhisthana, to the Bodhicitta. And it's not just about you, but it's something that includes others. And you'll actually be working with others in relation to that. Well, yes, that makes complete and utter sense. It did then, and, well, it does even more now. But let me go back to what I was saying about Shantideva. The sense is of something miraculous happening, the discovery of something extraordinary. The famous verse, just like a blind man who finds by chance a priceless jewel in a heap of muck, so somehow this bodhicitta has arisen in me. Just as a blind man may find by chance a priceless jewel in a heap of muck, so somehow this bodhicitta has arisen in me. It's a surprise. It's an incredible wonder. There's no sense of, I have a big attainment. I am the big important person. No, the feeling is one of incredible humility, surprise, and thanksgiving and rejoicing. Throughout the Bodhicharyavatara, there's lots of expressions of gratitude, thanksgiving, rejoicing, and praising at how extraordinary this is, that somebody like me, this could happen. I take that to mean that Shantideva was a man so absorbed in living the Dharma life fully and completely, studying, meditating, performing puja, observing his ethics, following his teachers, so absorbed in that, he's forgotten completely about any idea of getting anywhere, any notion of any kind of ambition, any kind of attainment. So when this transfiguration happens, there is just wonder, amazement, gratitude, and thanksgiving. There is puja. There is puja. You find in the Bodhicharyavatara long, wonderfully long puja. And this is perhaps why that the sevenfold puja is regarded as one of the main practices to bring about the arising of the bodhicitta. And I'm going to end this talk by just reminding you of how that happens. Again, Bhante's description of the sevenfold puja and as a practice and what you're doing it. Again, I found that just so wonderful. Again, it's foundational. I keep coming back to the way he talks. He talks about the sevenfold puja being a sequence of seven devotional moods. I found that a very, very attractive way of talking. That through the verses, through the whole atmosphere you create, you're moving through different moods. In Indian aesthetics, they talk about rasa, tasting, the taste of a particular mood of a work of art, be it dance or music or drama, probably painting as well, certainly poetry. And Bhante was also very, very keen on speaking of the sevenfold puja as poetry and devotion. Poetry and devotion. So the aesthetic needs to be very, very strong in the puja. And you don't get just this word rasa, you get the word bhava. Bhava can be translated as something like mood. Very important in Indian, not just aesthetics, but in religious life as well, where they overlap. So we need to enter into these moods, open up to these changing moods, which together start to open us to the bodhicitta. So first of all, there's worship. You worship, you get it in the English word, you worship that which has worth, that which has supreme value for you. That's what you worship. And worship is adorning, even adoring, your highest spiritual ideals with beauty. That's what you're doing in worship. And you notice that the verses of the sevenfold puja, the first verse is immediately you're in this very, very beautiful world. Second word is an archetypal flower. A mandarava is a gigantic orange cartwheel sized flower. So immediately you're visualizing a great orange flower to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It's supreme worship. It's the worship of the Bodhisattvas to the Buddha. The Bhante quotes Jayi as saying that the highest wisdom practice of advanced Bodhisattvas is to worship and praise the Buddhas. So you're moving into this very, very beautiful first stage of the puja. adorning the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And of course, physically we do that with flowers and lights and incense. We're changing and elevating our state. Then of course we realize in salutation that we're a very, very long way from that ideal. It's so attractive, so fascinating, so beautiful. It's very, very important to identify our ideal as beautiful. If it's not beautiful for us, we won't move towards it. It won't hold us sufficiently emotionally. With salutation, we're seeing it's vast. We're a very, very long way from it. We're tiny in relation to the vast mountain ranges of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the great teachers. And we just want to bow down. We're just in that mood of just bowing our head. We should really spend days on each of these seven stages. But even though it's so far away, it's so sublime, nonetheless, there is something in us that wants and needs and longs to move in the direction of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the Dharma. So we go for refuge. We go for refuge. We make that act of commitment. So there's a strong volition coming out of from worship to salutation. Then the volition that these are at the centre of our life. These are the truly reliable things that won't let us down. And of course, we have the traditional refuges and precepts chanted afterwards to keep us in touch with the earliest Buddhist tradition. And then, of course, there's confession. Confession of evil, confession of faults, papa, deshana. We realise after we've committed, we realise all the things that are in the way. All the things that we've done, that we continue to do, that obstruct our movement in the direction of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, that obstruct the arising of the bodhicitta. And the language is very strong. It's papa, it's evil. A lot of Western Buddhists say, well, I don't like that word. I have a difficult time with that word. No, but it is evil. There's no other way of translating papa. Faults is far too weak. And the thing that you need to reflect upon is, are you sure that you're not capable of great evil? We are very, very supported and sustained by the conditions around us, by living in a relatively law-abiding society, relatively. We're not living in a civil war realm. We're not living in a world of anarchy. We don't know what we would do if our life was threatened or the life of our loved ones until we've completely extirpated the roots of unskillfulness. We are capable of evil. The other way you could look at it, for a bodhisattva, someone aspiring to be a bodhisattva, even the slightest fault is seen as a serious impediment to the full flowing of bodhicitta. Dada Rinpoche, who gave Bhante the bodhisattva vow, when he talked, his training was incredibly strict. His teacher, when I talked to him about his teacher, he wept with gratitude for his teacher. It was a very simple monk, but he was extremely strict. Extremely strict. Why? Because he was being trained to be a bodhisattva. He was being trained not just to live a Dharma life for himself, but for the benefit of everybody. We don't do that kind of strictness. Well, we wouldn't get away with it, but nor would we want to. But that was the sense of Dada Rinpoche's training. So confession of evil, really laying bare to yourself and to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas everything that stands in the way. And then there's rejoicing, because if you've cleared the way, you can look around and you're free to really take delight in all the good around you. Yes, the good in you, the good in the Sangha, the good of the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the glorious good of the great bodhicitta. You're in that mood of expansive sympathetic joy. It's not just there to kind of balance confession of faults. That's too psychological, although it does do that. It's more like having, you know, confessed your faults, having got rid of all those faults, you can then really be joyful. You've really put down the burden. Then, with this mind that's becoming, through these moods, more and more pliable, more and more moist, more and more open, receptive, then you entreat. You want the Dhamma. You want to hear the Dhamma. You want the Buddhas to teach. You want the Buddhas to stay. You want to learn about the bodhicitta from the sources of the bodhicitta. So entreaty and supplication, it's more than just receptivity. It's something very, very urgent. You really want to hear the teaching, know the teaching, see the teaching, not for yourself, not just for yourself, but for everybody. You want the light of the Dharma to shine, so you urgently entreat the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Then there's a reading, and this is why we shouldn't shuffle around. It's not a sort of break in the puja. We must listen very attentively when the reading comes, because this is the teaching that we've asked for. We also have the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra, of course, is taught by great compassion. Avalokiteshvara teaches Shariputra emptiness. Great compassion reveals emptiness. Actually, the Heart Sutra is about the bodhicitta. That's the much better way to think of it. It's about seeing through the difference between self and other. That's what the Heart Sutra is really all about. It's about unleashing compassion and going beyond where you are now, moving on into greater and greater service of the Buddha Dhamma. That's what really the Heart Sutra is describing. And then after that, having experienced the Dharma in that way, having had a sort of taste even of Shunyata, you transfer the merits for the benefit of all. And Bhante makes the point that that only really works when you have a realization of Shunyata. Then, when you see no difference between self and other, then your virtue flows out. But we need to keep dedicating our merits to make sure that our practice isn't just for ourselves, it's for the benefit of all. With Bhante's arrangement of the puja, you then have the mantras. And he describes the mantra, the bodhisattvas in the Bodhisattva Ideal series on the section on the bodhisattvas. They are all expressions of bodhicitta. All of the different bodhisattvas are expressions of the absolute bodhicitta. You're meditating on bodhicitta. It's as if the mantras are actually the arising of the bodhicitta, at least in imagination. And then finally, with the three shantis, which are said to pacify greed, hatred and delusion at their root, we enter into that deep silence, and perhaps start opening up to the bodhicitta in the ultimate sense, beyond all language, beyond all ideas, beyond all images. Okay.
Thanks very much, brother. Thank you.